Who's the best Hamlet that you've ever seen? Is there such a thing?
Yes, Barrymore.
Barrymore. He must have been a very princely Hamlet, Barrymore.
Not so much princely. He was a man of genius.
Yes.
Who happened to be a prince. And he was tender and virile and witty and dangerous.
Hello, and welcome back to a special summer edition of Adventures in Theater History. The voice you just heard was the great actor and director Orson Welles, being interviewed in 1963, speaking about the greatest Hamlet he himself had ever seen, the Philadelphia-born actor John Barrymore. As Chris and I take a little time off to relax and recharge over the summer, we're doing our best not to neglect our regular listeners. We've been recording and sharing some interviews we've done with theater historians and important Philadelphia theater artists about various topics, and we hope you've been enjoying them. And we've been finding a lot of great historic audio material, like the clip you just heard, and sharing some of them with you, too. Earlier this year, we also made a special episode entitled The Mischianza, using Oh, It's a Lovely War, a chapter from the book Wicked Philadelphia, by Philadelphia historian Thomas H. Keels. Tom wrote about the Mischianza, that party-slash-pageant-slash-theatrical cosplay staged by British soldiers occupying Philadelphia during the Revolutionary War, and also about how Philadelphia's wealthy elite families, many of them direct descendants of those who likely collaborated with the British occupiers, later fetishized and reenacted the Mischianza in the 19th century. Well, that episode turned out so well that I've asked Tom if, during this summer, we might use another chapter from his book, one that was even more directly connected to the world of the theater and is, in fact, about one of Philadelphia's biggest claims to theatrical fame, the Barrymore family of actors. Although, since Tom, like my friend Joe Lex of the All Bones Considered podcast, is a tour guide at Laurel Hill Cemetery in Philadelphia, this chapter again takes us into the world of bodies, graves, and grisly details. It's still about theater, you know. I'm very happy to report that Tom kindly gave his permission for us to use it. So, the text I'm about to read is entirely the work of Thomas H. Keels. The book, Wicked Philadelphia, Sin in the City of Brotherly Love, is available on Amazon.com. Please visit Tom's website, www.thomaskeels.com, that's Keels, K-E-E-L-S, for more information on his other books and his upcoming talks and lectures. I'll put a link in the show notes. But before we begin Tom's chapter, let's play another historic YouTube clip, this one in the voice of John Barrymore himself, from a Hollywood screen test he made in 1933 from Act One of Shakespeare's Hamlet, as the prince stands on the battlements of Elsinore, confronting his father's ghost to the concern of his friend Horatio. As you'll see, it's very apt to the story that follows.
What may this mean? That thou dead corse, again in complete steel, revisitest thus the glimpses of the moon, making night hideous. Say, why is this? Wherefore? What should we do?
It beckons you to go away with it.
It will not speak.
Then will I follow it.
Do not be lord.
Why, what should be the fear? I do not set my life at a pin's fee. And for my soul, what can it do to that, being a thing immortal as itself? Go on. I'll follow thee.
Good night, sweet prince. John Barrymore comes home. The two policemen crept up behind the tall, thin man as he banged on the oak doors of the mansion, surrounded by a copse of trees and set far back from the highway. It was a cold December night in 1980. The police had received a nervous call a few minutes earlier from the Archbishop's residence, home of the top prelate of the Catholic Church in Philadelphia. An unidentified intruder had gotten onto the large wooded estate at 5700 City Avenue in the residential Winfield section. Now, the two officers responding to the call watched the stranger batter the massive doors of the palatial residence with his fists while he yelled for the Archbishop to come out. The officers positioned themselves behind the frantic man and glanced at each other. One removed his gun from his holster. The intruder looked unarmed, but they didn't want to take any chances. Crime had been on the rise in Philadelphia, especially after the assassination of mafia boss Angelo Bruno in April had triggered a gang war. Drug use was increasing too, and reports had surfaced of a highly addictive version of cocaine called crack, which made its users extremely paranoid and violent. Three police officers had been shot to death so far in 1980, the most in 5 years. As the officer released the safety on his gun, his partner turned his flashlight on the stranger, silhouetting him against the entrance. "Sir, will you please turn around? Step away from the door." Oblivious, the man continued to pound away. The first officer raised his gun. "Sir," the second officer shouted, "please step away from the door and raise your hands now." The intruder spun around, recoiling from the flashlight's beam like a vampire. As he slowly raised his arms, the officers checked him out. In his 40s, maybe 50s, dressed in jeans, jacket, and open-neck shirt despite the frigid winter night, shaggy hair and a beard obscured a haggard yet handsome face with high cheekbones and a prominent nose. Even in the flashlight's glare, the pupils of the man's deep-set eyes were dilated, definitely high on something. "Oh, hello," the man's voice was gentle and confused. "Can you guys help me out?" He started to approach them, but stopped when he was ordered to freeze. He stood passively, swaying slightly, as the officer with the flashlight patted him down. No weapons. He surrendered his wallet without protest. The first officer stared at the ID and then showed it to his partner, a California driver's license. John Drew Barrymore, born June 4th, 1932. "What are you doing here, Mr. Barrymore?"
"I really need to talk to the Archbishop."
The officer with the flashlight smelled the faint aroma of grass. He relaxed a little. This guy was stoned, not likely to attack them, despite the assault on the doors.
"Well, you need to see the Archbishop, Mr. Barrymore." "For my dad. The Archbishop needs to bless my dad."
"Where is your father, Mr. Barrymore?" Barrymore glanced around nervously.
There he is."
Relieved, he pointed at a suitcase on the porch of the mansion.
"Okay," the officer felt his muscles tense again. "Mr. Barrymore, we'd like you to come with us. Now, you stay here. I'll get your father."
Over numerous cups of coffee at the 19th District Station, the meaning of the midnight visit gradually emerged. First, John Drew Barrymore had smoked some really dynamite weed on his flight from Los Angeles to Philadelphia, a fact he repeatedly shared with the entire station. Second, his father, or rather, a can containing his father's cremated remains, was indeed in his suitcase. Finally, John Barrymore, the Philadelphia-born actor who dazzled both Broadway and Hollywood in the early 20th century, had finally come home to rest. John Sidney Blythe Barrymore was the brightest star in a theatrical dynasty that had already lasted three generations when he made his debut on February 15th, 1882.
He was born at 2008 Columbia, now Cecil B. Moore, Avenue in North Philadelphia, in the home of his grandmother, Louisa Lane, Mrs. John Drew. Louisa had made her own stage debut in England at the age of 5 in 1825. 2 years later, her actor parents immigrated to the United States. Louisa grew up to become one of the darlings of America's two great theatrical capitals, Philadelphia and New York. She played opposite all the great actors of the day, including Edwin Forrest, Junius Brutus Booth, and Joseph Jefferson. In 1850, Louisa married actor John Drew, with whom she had three children, Louisa, John Jr., and Georgiana. In 1861, the Drews acquired the Down at Heels Art Street Theater at 609 to 615 Art Street, planning to restore it and become actor managers. The next year, John Drew died at the age of 34 after falling down the stairs at a party for 6-year-old Georgiana. The indomitable Louisa ran the theater herself and restored it to its former glory by persuading her famous friends to act there. At the same time, she raised her three children alone and even adopted a fourth child, Sidney, although rumors persisted that he was her illegitimate son. Two of Louisa's children, John Jr. and Georgiana, Georgie, became well-known actors themselves. In 1876, Georgie married Maurice Barrymore, an actor friend of her brother John. Georgie and Maurice had three children, all born in Philadelphia, Lionel, 1878, Ethel, 1879, and John, 1882. As Philadelphia's theatrical fortunes waned, the Barrymore spent much of their time in New York or touring on the road. Louisa became a surrogate parent to her grandchildren, who called her Mum-Mum. Shortly after John was born, Louisa moved from Columbia Avenue to 140 North 12th Street, a short walk from her theater. The three-story house, demolished when the convention center was built, had large high-ceilinged rooms, a nursery known as the Annex, and an attic where John and Lionel slept. Lionel, 4 years older than John, kept cages of white mice in the attic. They got loose and infested the entire house, bringing the cook to the verge of a breakdown. On special occasions, the three children were taken to the golden red velvet paradise known as the Art Street Theater, where they would sit in their grandmother's private box to watch shows. Besides the Barrymore children, 140 North 12th Street was home to Louisa's elderly mother, Eliza, and her two sons, John Jr., Uncle Jack, and Sidney, Uncle Guggen. Grandmother Eliza, who lived in the attic next to Lionel and John, had them recite a nightly prayer. God bless Mother, and Papa, and Mum-Mum, and Grandmother, and Uncle Guggen, and please God, make Uncle Jack a good actor. John Drew Jr. had a slow start in the theater due to his sloppy diction, and he sold clocks at Wanamaker's to make ends meet. He later became a popular matinee idol. Uncle Guggen was a talented actor, but preferred to spend his time hustling pool in the nearby Tenderloin. Young Lionel and John would accompany him to billiard halls as his mascots, their cherubic faces helping to lull unsuspecting pigeons into games with the expert Sidney. The two boys also acted as advance guards, keeping an eye out for sore losers lying in wait for Uncle Guggen. All three children attended private schools in Philadelphia. Ethel went to Notre Dame Academy, an exclusive Catholic girls' school on Rittenhouse Square. As a small child, John attended a junior school at Notre Dame, where he enjoyed drawing pictures of devils and demons on the blackboard to scare the younger pupils. Lionel attended the old Episcopal Academy at Locust and Juniper Streets, but when he showed off his prep school education by calling the family maid a son of a bitch, he was quickly transferred to a Catholic school. The children's mother had converted from the Episcopal faith to Catholicism under the influence of actress Helena Modjeska. In 1889, Georgie and Maurice Barrymore settled in New York, which had eclipsed Philadelphia as America's theatrical crossroads. They brought with them 11-year-old Lionel, 10-year-old Ethel, and 7-year-old John. 3 years later, Louisa Drew sold the Art Street Theater and moved to New York to join her family. But the Barrymore clan began to splinter shortly after. In 1892, Georgie died of tuberculosis at a California sanitarium, with Ethel by her side. Maurice was on the road, and 14-year-old Ethel had to accompany her mother's body back east. Less than a year after Georgie's death, the notoriously unfaithful Maurice married another actress named Mamie Floyd, earning Louisa's enmity. Mamie later seduced her stepson, John, when he was only 14, not long before Maurice was committed to the Bellevue Hospital insane ward with dementia induced by alcoholism and syphilis. Lionel and Ethel, who had both made their acting debuts as children at Louisa's Arch Street Theater, were soon on the road themselves, having begun their theatrical apprenticeships with various touring companies. A special bond had always existed between Louisa and John, her youngest grandchild. With the rest of his family away, the motherless boy grew even closer to his mum-mum. In 1897, 15-year-old John spent a happy summer with 77-year-old Louisa at a resort hotel in Larchmont, New York. They sat on the beach, looking out on Long Island Sound. Louisa read, while John, a talented amateur artist, sketched. They both knew she was terminally ill. "I saw you come into this world," she told him at one point, "and now you are seeing me out of it. A fair exchange." Louisa died of congenital heart failure at the end of the summer. With her strict discipline and all-encompassing love, Louisa had been an anchor of strength for her quicksilver grandson until his death. John would remember her Philadelphia household as a sanctuary. When his own life grew increasingly chaotic, John longed increasingly for the warmth and stability of his grandmother's home. On theatrical opening nights, the Drew and Barrymore families always sent each other red apples as gifts. Speaking of Louisa, years after her death, John said, "If such a thing be possible, I know that at Heaven's Gate, Mum-Mum was given not a red apple, but one of purest gold when she entered there." After flirting with a career as an artist, John decided to follow his parents and siblings into the theater. His first professional appearance was in the Philadelphia tryout of Clyde Fitch's Captain Jinks of the Horse Marines, a star vehicle for his sister Ethel. When the show debuted at the Walnut Street Theater in January 1901, John went on as a last-minute substitute for another actor. He muffed his few lines, and then ad-libbed, "Where do we go from here?" At this point, Ethel went into a hysterical state that, John recalled later, was a cross between hilarity and strangulation. John capped the evening by taking a solitary curtain call. He was dropped from the cast when the play moved to Broadway, where it made Ethel a star. Despite this inauspicious debut, John soon joined Ethel and Lionel on Broadway, where the three became known as the Royal Family of the American Theater. He starred in numerous popular and classical plays and was acclaimed as the finest Hamlet of his generation. Around 1914, Barrymore began a film career that would enthrone him in Hollywood as well as on Broadway. Between 1914 and 1941, he appeared in over 50 films, starring in such classics as Don Juan, Dinner at Eight, and Grand Hotel. As a young man, his athletic physique made him one of Hollywood's first male sex symbols, while his striking features, especially his long, perfectly shaped nose, earned him the sobriquet The Great Profile. Sadly, John's love of liquor, which had first manifested itself in childhood when he chugged the dregs of adults' cocktails at family parties, blossomed into full-blown alcoholism before he reached middle age. In 1920, while appearing on Broadway as Richard III, he suffered his first alcohol-induced nervous breakdown, publicly attributed to fatigue and overwork. Barrymore biographer Gene Fowler estimated that the actor consumed 640 barrels of hard liquor over 40 years. By the late 1930s, Barrymore could not remember lines and was reduced to supporting roles in B-films like The Invisible Woman. He divorced his third wife, Dolores Costello, in 1935, to move in with and then marry a 19-year-old college student named Elaine Barry. Elaine, Barrymore's fourth and final wife, was a would-be actress whose greatest cinematic achievement was a short subject entitled How to Undress in Front of Your Husband. The two divorced in 1937, reunited, and divorced again in 1940. On May 19, 1942, John Barrymore collapsed during rehearsals for Rudy Valley's radio show, where he had a recurring role as a washed-up ham actor. He was taken to the Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital, floating in and out of unconsciousness for 10 days, while his family and friends stood by helplessly. The 60-year-old actor died on May 29th of myocarditis, complicated by cirrhosis of the liver, chronic nephritis, and gastric ulcers, all results of his alcoholism. His last words were, "You heard me, Mike." A response when his brother Lionel, whom John called Mike, asked John to repeat himself. According to Hollywood legend, a group of Barrymore's hard-drinking cronies held a wake at the Cock and Bull Bar after his death. Among them were Errol Flynn, swashbuckling star of epics like Robin Hood and Captain Blood, and Raoul Walsh, one-eyed director of The Roaring Twenties and High Sierra. Flynn, one of the last to leave the bar that night, stumbled home to Beverly Hills and flicked on the hall lights. He stared into the bloated, white, bloodless face of the corpse of John Barrymore. Screaming hysterically, Flynn ran outside, only to be stopped by Raoul Walsh and two other drinking buddies. After leaving the Cock and Bull, the three men had stopped by Pierre Brothers Mortuary on Sunset Boulevard and paid the night attendant $200 to borrow Barrymore's body. They drove to Flynn's house in Beverly Hills and propped the unembalmed corpse in a chair as a joke. After they calmed Flynn down, the three men returned Barrymore's remains to the morgue, while Flynn staggered upstairs to spend a sleepless night. In his will, John Barrymore had expressed his desire to be cremated and to have his ashes buried in the Barrymore-Drew lot in Philadelphia's Mount Vernon Cemetery, next to his parents and beloved grandmother. Ethel and Lionel Barrymore overrode their brother's wishes. Instead, they had John's body entombed in the mausoleum at Calvary Cemetery, a Catholic burial ground in Los Angeles. They would later join John there, as would ex-wife Dolores Costello. John Barrymore's remains rested at Calvary for nearly 40 years, until his only son decided to fulfill his father's wishes. John Drew Barrymore was born John Sidney Blythe Barrymore, Jr. in 1932, the child of Barrymore and third wife Dolores Costello. An infant when his parents divorced in 1935, John Jr. remembered seeing his famous father only once. Despite his mother's objections, John decided to become an actor just like his father. Unfortunately, John had major substance abuse issues just like his father. His acting career was curtailed by his drunkenness, his drug use, violent outbursts, and frequent incarcerations. His three marriages produced two children, John Sidney Blythe Barrymore III, born 1954, and Drew Barrymore, yes, that Drew Barrymore, born 1975. After John's death in 2004, at age 72, one of his obituaries read that he was, quote, best known for having embraced the Barrymore predilection for hard living and reckless drinking. In December 1980, the reclusive Barrymore impulsively decided to have his father cremated and reburied in Philadelphia, supposedly after hearing a rendition of the Robert Service poem, The Cremation of Sam McGee. He and his son had the body removed from Calvary and taken to the crematorium at Oddfellows Cemetery. According to legend, John decided to look at his father's corpse once it was removed from its silver-plated copper coffin. Evidently, moving the coffin had dislodged the jaw from the rest of his skull. Although most of the flesh of the face had decomposed, the great profile's long nose cartilage remained intact. He stumbled into the car afterwards, white as a sheet, and told his son, "Thank God I'm drunk. I'll never remember it." A lawyer for the family called the Pennsylvania Burial Company in South Philadelphia to let it know that John Drew Barrymore would be coming east with his father's ashes. 2 weeks later, with the help of some chemical courage, Barrymore flew to Philadelphia with his father's ashes on his lap. Arriving late at night, the confused Barrymore made his way to the city's western edge, fueled by the desire to have his father's ashes blessed before they were interred. On December 12, 1980, the remains of John Barrymore were laid to rest at Mount Vernon Cemetery in the presence of a single undertaker. John Drew Barrymore placed his father's ashes in the ground next to the grave of Louisa Lane Drew. "Now it is finished," John said. He then flew back to California. He left behind an unpaid bill to the Pennsylvania Burial Company for $930, which included a $200 cash advance, and no plans to commemorate or care for his father's grave. John Barrymore's resting place would remain unmarked for 18 years, until a group of local fans raised funds to purchase a monument. Today, Mount Vernon Cemetery at Ridge and Allegheny Avenues is a derelict and forlorn place. Its gates are usually locked, and visitors rarely stroll along its paths. Periodically, suggestions are made to move the Barrymore Drew plot across Ridge Avenue to more upscale Laurel Hill Cemetery. Others have suggested that America's foremost acting dynasty be taken across the Schuylkill River to West Laurel Hill Cemetery in Lower Merion, where they could join other retired actors in the burial lot for the Edwin Forrest home. Until that day arrives, one of the world's greatest actors remains hidden away at Mount Vernon Cemetery. John Barrymore's grave is marked only by a small granite oblong that reads, "Alas, poor Yorick," a reference to the finest Hamlet Broadway has ever seen. So that was "Good Night, Sweet Prince" from the book Wicked Philadelphia by Thomas H. Keels, published by the History Press in 2010. The text is copyrighted by Thomas H. Keels, all rights reserved. I might add that a few of the minor details about the life and career of Louisa Lane Drew in Tom's account differ slightly from our own episodes 18 and 19 about the Duchess of Arch Street. Well, all I can say is that the work of every single historian is an ongoing project, and when I was doing my own research, I was able to benefit from the additional work that others had done and that had been published since Tom's book was printed in 2010. And, you know, we're not frozen in time here in Philly, either. Things move along. Tom Keels wrote me recently to tell me that those final notes in his story about the derelict state of Mount Vernon Cemetery are no longer strictly true, I'm happy to report. Tom tells me that a group of volunteers were recently granted control of Mount Vernon after many years of its being in the clutches of an absentee landlord. Their web address is www.mountvernoncemetery.org, and that's Mount Vernon Cemetery, all one word. They have been working to restore the cemetery, and the graves of the Barrymore and Drew family are high up on their list. There's no longer talk of relocating the graves, but the group needs some funds, so help them out if you can. As to where Tom got the story about the Philly cops who busted John Barrymore Jr. when he was banging on the door of the Archbishop's Mansion on City Line Avenue back in 1980, you won't find those published anywhere else. Tom says he heard the story firsthand from the cop himself, who is now a retired member of the Philadelphia Police Department, when he went on one of Tom's tours at Laurel Hill Cemetery. The guy was very nice and provided the details used to set the scene at the start of the chapter. Tom got the man's name at the time, but unfortunately managed to lose it and hasn't been able to get back in touch with him since the book came out. So if you or anyone you know knows who this gentleman is, please contact us here and we'll let Tom know. Anyway, that's our special summer episode.
I'm Peter Schmitz, and the sound engineering is by Christopher Mark Colucci. We'll be back again in August, or maybe before. We'll see. Check out our website, aithpodcast.com, to find blog posts and all our previous episodes. And if you like to write to us, our email is aithpodcast@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show, please, please, please leave some stars and a brief review on Apple Podcasts or right there on the website. We've opened up our Patreon page again, so that's another way to support our work and to help get us some funds to keep the website and the podcast feed going, you know, and generally to lift our spirits. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook, where we do daily posts about theater history in Philadelphia. Be a part of the Philly theater history community. Thanks so much for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia. But instead of me giving that catchphrase as the last word, let's give the final word today, as we should, to the greatest Hamlet Broadway has ever seen, John Blythe Barrymore.
Now I am alone. What a rogue and peasant slave am I? Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wand, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing. For Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him or he to Hecuba that he should weep for her? What would he do? Had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have?